this lecture, entitled The Ice Age and the Recreation of the World, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Rafol Yehuda Elchonon ben Miriam Rochel, the Rafua Shleima. As we've pointed out in previous lectures, the world has repeatedly experienced catastrophic upheavals, has undergone radical change. We quoted the tradition, the life existed on this planet well before the Sheshesh Yemei Bereishis, the 6 days of creation. And it terminated, in the words of the Medrash Mesichta D'Atzilus, here on page 1, in paragraph A, "The Holy One, blessed be He, originally created worlds and destroyed them, trees and uprooted them, because they, the people of the world, were hasty and were jealous of one another." Subsequently, after the Sheshesh Yemei Bereishis, the 6 days of creation, in the generation of Enosh, at the end of the first millennium, there was once again a major upheaval which resulted in the destruction of a third of the world. In the words of the Sifrei, here is on first page, paragraph B, "At the time of Enosh, the ocean inundated a third of the world." Less than 700 years later, a second flood swept the world, destroyed virtually all of human and animal life, with the exception of Noah and those together with him in the Teva, the Ark. This was clearly a flood of extraordinary proportions. In the words of the Torah, here on paragraph C, "Nifku kol mayanos tohim rabba varubas hashamayim niftochu." All the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heavens were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. The earth literally boiled as superheated water from below the earth's crust merged with the waters of the sea and the rain from above. In the words of the Talmud, Rosh Hashanah, this is Yud Beis Amud Aleph here. Rav Chisda said, "With hot liquid they sinned, and with hot liquid they were punished." With hot liquid they sinned, mainly in sexual transgression. With hot liquid they were punished, as it is written here, regards to the Mabul, Ve'yishoichu Hamoyim, and the waters were assuaged. And that we find a parallel to that is written elsewhere in Esther, Bogvesser, "And the wrath of the heat of the king was assuaged." The Hamas is referred to heat. It's his rage. And find the parallel, evidently, it's an allusion to the fact about the heat of the water. For a period of 150 days after the original 40 days rainfall, the world was in a state of vast turmoil. As the verse states here, this is in the bottom of page 1, in the translation on top of page 2, "And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bore up the ark, and was lifted up above the earth. And the waters prevailed, and they were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went up upon the face of the waters. The waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all of the high hills that were under the whole heavens were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. And in the words of the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Rosh Yeshiva Voloshin, in his commentary to these words, "And the waters increased, prevailed," Ramban explains this verse correctly, that it means that the waters came with great force and uprooted the trees. You notice the parallel to the first citation we had, Masechta D'Atzilus, about the destruction of the original world before the 6 days. "And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth," the Netziv comments. "The waters went on to uproot great stretches of land. Through this activity, mountains and hills that didn't exist before the flood were formed. This is obviously so, for the mountains of Ararat are portrayed as being the highest mountains on earth, and this is not true. Rather, those higher mountains came to be through the flood. For those mountains that are presently higher than the mountains of Ararat came into being during the days of the flood." just to give you an idea about the relative heights of the mountains, Mount Ararat consists of two volcanic peaks. Great Ararat, rising to 5,122 meters, or 16,804 feet, and Little Ararat, or 3,896 meters, or it's 12,782 feet above sea level, in extreme eastern Turkey near Iran and Armenia. It's assumed that the Ark landed on the higher mountain, on Greater Ararat. As Nassif pointed out, these peaks are considerably lower than the world's highest peaks. Mount Everest, part of the Great Himalayas, is over 29,000 feet above sea level. The Greater Ararat is 16,804 feet. The average height of the mountains of this range of the Himalayas is over 20,000 feet. And the Andes Mountains in South America have over 40 peaks that are over 20,000 feet above sea level. Now, there's a strong indication to support the Nassif's interpretation that these mountains had not reached their present height at the time of creation, but actually rose in the age of man. I'd like to quote to you from Dr. Manuel Velikovsky's classic work, Earth in Upheaval. First, as an introduction, I'd like to quote to you from page 68 of that book, quote, "Could it be that the mountains rose as late as in the age of man and carried with them the caverns of early man? In recent years, evidence has grown rapidly to show, in contrast to previous opinions, that the Alps and the other mountains rose and attained their present heights and also traveled long distances in the age of man." Velikovsky now quotes from geologist Richard Foster Flint of Yale University, his Glacial Geology in the Pleistocene Epoch, in pages 9 to 10, quote, "Mountain uplifts amounting to many thousands of feet have occurred within the Pleistocene epoch." Pleistocene is the ice age itself. "This occurred with the Cordilleran mountain system in both North and South America, the Alps, Caucasus, and Central Asian system, and many others," end quote. Velikovsky now continues, "The fact of the late upthrust of the major ridges of the world created, when recognized, great perplexity amongst geologists who, under the weight of much evidence, were forced to this view. The revision of the concept is not always radical enough. Not only in the age of man, but in the age of historical man, mountains were thrust up, valleys were torn out, lakes were dragged uphill and emptied. Helmut Gams and Rolf Nordhagen brought together very extensive material concerning the Bavarian Alps and the Tyrol, or Eastern Alps. Quote, the great mountain chains challenged credulity by their extreme youth," wrote explorer Bailey Willis about Asian mountains. Okay, and starting from page 75, Velikovsky writes, quote, "In the Andes, at 16 degrees 22 minutes south latitude," means below the equator, "a megalithic city was found at an elevation of 12,500 feet in a region where corn will not ripen. The term megalithic fits the dead city only in regard to the great size of the stones in its walls, some of which are flattened and joined with precision. It is situated on the Altiplano, the elevated plain between the western and eastern cordilleras, not far from Lake Titicaca, the largest lake in South America, and the highest navigable lake in the world on the border of Bolivia and Peru." And he quotes, "There is a mystery still unsolved on the plateau of Lake Titicaca, which, if stones could speak, would reveal a story of deepest interest. Much of the difficulty in the solution of this mystery is caused by the nature of the region in the present day, where the enigma still defies explanation," end quote. So wrote Sir Clemens Markham in 1910, quote, "Such a region is only capable of sustaining a scanty population of hardy mountaineers and laborers. The mystery consists in the existence of ruins of a great city at the southern side of the lake, the builders being entirely unknown. The city covered a large area built by highly skilled masons and with the use of enormous stones, end quote. When the author of the quoted passages posed this question to the scholarly world, Leonard Darwin, then president of the Royal Geographical Society, offered the surmise that the mountains had risen considerably after the city had been built. Is such an idea beyond the bounds of possibility? Asked Sir Clemens. Under the assumption that the Andes were once some 2,000 or 3,000 feet lower than they are now, maize would then ripen in the basin of Lake Titicaca, and the site of the ruins of Tiwanaku, that's the name of that they gave to the city, could support the necessary population. If the megalithic builders were living under these conditions, the problem is solved. If this is geologically impossible, the mystery remains unexplained, end quote. Several years ago, another authority, A. Poznanski, wrote in a similar vein, quote, at the present time, the plateau of the Andes is inhospitable and almost sterile. With the present climate, it would not have been suitable in any period as the asylum for great human masses of the most important prehistoric center of the world. Endless agricultural terraces of the people lived, this is in the region in pre-Inca days, can still be recognized. Today, this region is at a very great height above sea level. In remote periods, it was lower, end quote. And Velikovsky goes on to explain the terraces in this Tiwanaku rise to a height of 15,000 feet, 2,500 feet above Tiwanaku. After it's in Tiwanaku, it's so high up that corn does not ripen. And yet, this went up 25 feet. The terraces went up 25 feet where they planted them. And still higher, up to 18,400 feet above sea level, or to the present line of eternal snow on Imani. This is one of the highest mountains in South America. They found other terraces. And those other terraces went up to the snow line, and who knows, maybe they're covered with snow. They went up at least 18,000 feet. So it's saying that there must have been a time that was much lower. And it continues on, the conservative view among evolutionists and geologists is that mountain making is a slow process, observable in minute changes, and that because it is a continuous process, there never could have been spontaneous uplifting on a large scale. In the case of Tiwanaku, however, the change in altitude apparently occurred after the city was built, and this could not have been the result of a slow process that required hundreds of thousands of years to produce a visible alteration. Once, Tiwanaku was at the water's edge. Then, Lake Titicaca was 90 feet higher, as its old strand line discloses, you know, the line where the shore once was. But this strand line is tilted. In another place, it is more than 360 feet above the present level of the lake. There are numerous raised beaches, and stress was put on, quote, the freshness of many of the strand lines and the modern character of such fossils as occur. And then it continues on, further investigation of topography of the Andes and the fauna of Lake Titicaca, together with a chemical analysis of this lake and others on the same plateau, established that the plateau was at one time at sea level, or 12,500 feet lower than it is today. You know, just as an aside, and I don't know the full bearing of this, Thor Heyerdahl, you know, the explorer, had a theory that he noticed that the boats that were used by the natives on Lake Titicaca were virtually the same as were used by the ancient Egyptians. So he had a theory that perhaps ancient Egyptians colonized that area. And he built a ship. First he built what was called the Ra. It's taken to hell. It failed. But then he had the Ra too. And the Ra too, he actually traveled. Of course, he had a little help, you know, in the end. But he traveled in such a boat that he constructed all the way from Egypt till South America. The fact is they're using that boat way up above. You know, would be indicative that perhaps it was a little lower at that time. And it continues on here. At a higher elevation, the sediment of an enormous dried up lake, whose waters were almost potable, is full of characteristic mollusks, such as Paludistrina and Ancylus, which show that it is, geologically speaking, of relatively modern origin. And it continues on, sometime in the remote past, the entire Altiplano, with its lakes, rose from the bottom of the ocean. At some other point, a city was built there, and terraces were laid out on the elevation around it. Then, in another disturbance, the mounds were thrust up, and the area became uninhabitable. Archaeological and radiocarbon analysis indicate that the age of the Andean culture in the city is not much older than 4,000 years. Sometimes in the remote past, the Altiplano was at or above sea level. Now, currently, the thinking is that it was really much more recent, this city, than it continues. So that originally, its lakes were part of a sea gulf. The last upheaval, however, took place in an early historical period after the city of Tiwanaku had been built. The lakes were dragged up, and the Altiplano and the entire chain of the Andes rose to their present height. The foothills of the Andes hide numerous deserted towns and abandoned terraces, monuments of a vanished civilization. The terraces that go up the slopes of the Andes and reach the eternal snow line and continue under the snow to some unidentified altitude prove that it was not a conqueror nor a plague that put the seal of death on the gardens and towns. In Peru, aerial surveys in the dry belt west of the Andes have shown an unexpected number of old ruins and an almost incredible number of terraces for cultivation. End quote. It's evident from Velikovsky's description that the Andes mountains rose to their height in historic times. Was it caused by the marble or subsequent cataclysm, or it's a result of a series of cataclysms? This we'll discuss perhaps at a later time. In addition, Velikovsky, starting from page 68 of his Earth and Upheaval, quotes compelling evidence that the Himalaya mountain range, containing some of the tallest mountains in the world, also rose in the age of man. Let me quote you from that section. Quote, the Himalayas, highest mountains in the world, rise like a 1,000-mile-long wall north of India. This mountain wall stretches from Kashmir in the west to and beyond Bhutan in the east, with many of its peaks towering over 20,000 feet and Mount Everest reaching 29,000 feet, or over 5 miles. The summits of these lofty massifs are capped by eternal snow in these regions of the heavens, where eagles do not fly, nor do any other bird of the sky. Scientists of the 19th century were dismayed to find that, as high as they climbed, the rocks of the massifs yielded skeletons of marine animals, fish that swim in the ocean, and shells of mollusks. This was evidence that the Himalayas had risen from beneath the sea. At some time in the past, azure waters of the ocean streamed over Mount Everest, carrying fish, crabs, and mollusks, and marine animals looked down to where now we look up, and where man, after many unsuccessful efforts, has until now succeeded only once in putting his feet. This was written, Velikovsky wrote this in 1955, shortly after Sir Edmund Hillary of New Zealand, with a Sherpa guide Tenzing Norgay of Nepal, scaled Mount Everest. And he continues on. Until recently, it was assumed that the Himalayas rose from the bottom of the sea to their present height tens or perhaps hundreds of millions of years ago. Such a long period of time, so long ago, was enough even for the Himalayas to have risen to their present height. Do we not, when we tell young listeners a story about giants and monsters, begin with, quote, once upon a time, long, long ago, end quote. And the giants are no longer threatening, and the monsters are no longer real. According to the general geological scheme, 500 million years ago, the first form of life appeared on Earth. 200 million years ago, life developed into reptilian forms that dominated the scene, achieving gigantic size. The huge reptiles died out 70 million years ago, and mammals occupy the Earth. They belong to the tertiary. That is a commonly accepted third epoch period of life on Earth, the first being the Paleozoic, the second the Mesozoic, which is the age of dinosaurs. According to this scheme, the last mountain uplifts took place at the end of the tertiary during the Pliocene. This period lasted until a million years ago. When the quaternary period, this means the fourth period, the age of man, began. Now, Velikovsky is explaining all of this, according to the commonly held scientific view, which he personally disagrees, at least much of it. And he continues on, the quaternary is also the time of the Ice Age, or the Pleistocene, the Paleolithic, or Old Stone Age. And the very end of the quaternary, since the end of the Ice Age, is called recent time, the Neolithic. Neo is late, the late or polished stone, which is also bronze and iron cultures. Since the appearance of man on Earth, or since the beginning of the Ice Age, there have been no uplifts or any substantial scale. He's just quoting the commonly held scientific belief. In other words, we've been told the profile of the Earth with its mountains and oceans was already established when man first appeared. In the last few decades, however, numerous facts have emerged from mountains and valleys that tell a different story. In Kashmir, Helmut de Terra discovered sedimentary deposits of an ancient sea bottom that was elevated at places to an altitude of 5,000 feet or more and tilted at an angle of as much as 400. The basin was dragged up by the rise of the mountain, but this was entirely unexpected. Quote, "These deposits contain Paleolithic fossils." That is, fossils of early or Stone Age man. And this, according to Arnold Heim, Swiss geologist, would make it plausible that the mountain passes in the Himalayas may have risen in the age of man 3,000 feet or more, however fantastic changes so extensive may seem to modern geologists. Studies on the Ice Age in India and the associated human cultures published in 1939 by De Hera, working for the Carnegie Institution, with the assistance of Professor T.T. Patterson of Harvard University, is one long argument and demonstration the Himalayas were rising during the Glacial Age and reached their present heights only after the end of the Glacial Age, and actually in historic times. From other mountain ridges came similar reports. De Hera divided the Ice Age of the Kashmir slope of the Himalayas into Lower Pleistocene, which is embracing the first glacial interglacial stages, Middle Pleistocene, the second major glaciation, and the following interglacial, and Upper Pleistocene, comprising the last two glaciations and an interglacial stage. Just as an aside for clarification, the Ice Age is the time when glaciers or mountains of ice covered a sizable part of the planet. Is commonly divided into four periods. At least that was the thinking during the time of Velikovsky, with three interglacial periods. And there's this Ice Age. Actually, there were four Ice Ages. Yeah. In other words, the Ice Age is really, they understood as really four periods of Ice Ages. An Ice Age is covered, mountains of ice cover the part of the Earth. There's an interglacial period where it melts, and then another Ice Age, and it melts, and another Ice Age, it melts, and another Ice Age. So there's four glacial periods, where the whatever it is, it was and commonly understood to be a very long period of time. In the beginning of this period, the fauna was greatly impoverished. This is what the findings based on the of the diggings of the research. But thereafter, judging from remains, large cats, elephants, true horses, pigs, and hippopotami occupied the area. Now, things don't grow there anymore. In the middle Pleistocene or Ice Age, there was a continued uplift. The archaeological records prove that early Paleolithic man inhabited the adjoining plains. This is very high up. But the adjoining plains, early man, was the Hera refers to abundance of Paleolithic sites. In other words, man was living in an area where man cannot live anymore. Evidently, it was uplifted. Man used stone implements of quote-unquote flake form, like those found in the Cromer forest bed in England. Then once more, the Himalayas were pushed upward. The tilting of terraces and lacustrine, means lake beds, indicate a continued uplift of the entire Himalayan tract during the last phases of the Ice Age. In the last phases of the Ice Age, when man worked stones in the mountains, he might have been living in the Bronze Stage down in the valleys. It's been repeatedly admitted by various authorities, quoted subsequently in this book, that the end of the glacial epoch may have been almost contemporaneous with the time of the rise of the great cultures of antiquity, of Egypt and Sumeria, and the falls also of India and China. The Stone Age in some regions could have been contemporaneous with the Bronze Age in others. Even now, there are numerous tribes in Africa, Australia, and Tierra del Fuego, the southern tip of the Americas, still living in the Stone Age. And many other regions of the modern world would have remained in the Stone Age had it not been for the importation of iron from more advanced regions. The Aborigines of Tasmania never got as far to produce a polished Neolithic stone implement, and in fact barely entered the crudest Stone Age. This large island south of Australia was discovered in 1642 by Abel Tasman, as we call Tasmania. The last Tasmanian died in exile in 1876, and the race became extinct. The more recent uplifts in the Himalayas took place also in the age of modern man. Quote, the post-glacial terrace record suggests that there was at least one prominent post-glacial advance of ice, and this in the eyes of Deterra and Patterson is indicative of a diastrophic movement of the mountains, when they get folded up together. Diastrophic refers to the process of deformation that produces continents and ocean basins in the Earth's crust. And there's, you know, that the tectonic plates like crash together. We must be emphatic on one particular feature, namely the dependence of Pleistocene glaciation on the diastrophic character of a mobile mountain belt. This relationship, we feel, has not been sufficiently recognized in other glaciated regions such as Central Asia and the Alps, where similar, if not identical, conditions are found. In other words, the conditions of Ice Age go hand in hand with the conditions of mountain forming. Those major upheavals. And it seems that there's happened in the time of man. Continues on, the great massifs of the Himalayas rose to its present height in the age of modern, actually historical man. The highest mountains in the world are also the youngest. With their topmost peaks, the mountains have shattered the entire scheme of the geology of, quote, long, long ago, end quote. In other words, the highest mountains are the youngest. And there's strong evidence that the time of the Mabul, the flood, they have not risen anywhere near to their present heights. So it's more than likely, as Siv argues, that the time of the Mabul, of the deluge, Ararat, was the highest peak. Although God made a covenant with Noah never to destroy the entirety of mankind with a flood, sometime later, according to the Medrash Seder Olam, it was some 340 years after the deluge, the Mabul, mankind once again suffered a colossal calamity, an event associated with the building of the Tower of Babel, as once again a part of the world became inundated. In the words of the Talmud Yerushalmi and Shkolim, this is in in the sixth Perek Vov, in the sixth chapter, the sea overflowed twice. This is on paragraph G, page 2. Once during the generation of Enosh, and once during the generation of the separation, according to the Tower of Babel. According to the Medrash Brachos Rabbah, 30 of the 70 families of mankind, the clans or tribes of mankind, were lost during the devastation following the building of the Tower of Babel. Here in paragraph H, the rabbis explain, this is in Perek Lamed Ches, in chapter 38, in Brachos Rabbah, that the word Svayofetz, which is commonly translated as, and he scattered, is to be understood as V'yatzif, and he inundated. For he caused the sea to overflow, and it drowned 30 families. There was a large portion of mankind was wiped out at the time. In the previous lecture, we also spoke of the cosmic aspect of the Mabel, as two stars, or perhaps comets, came close to the earth. Here, this we quote in the last lecture, here we quote here on page 3 from the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and from the Gemara in Brachos in 59. It says, at the time of the Holy One, blessed be, he wanted to bring a flood upon the world. He took two stars from Kima, the Pleiades, and brought a flood upon the world. And we discussed in the last lecture, we quoted the Tosefta and Sota in the 10th chapter, the omnipresent changed the order of the world. This is, and the sun came out of the west and set in the east. This is the week before the flood actually occurred. For that reason it is written, and it came to be after the 7 days had passed. These were 7 days of major upheaval themselves. At the time of Devorah and Barak, during the time of the Shoftim, the judges, over 200 years after the Exodus, once again stars or comets came close to the earth. And here, again, is on page 3, paragraph B, in the Shiras Devorah, Song of Devorah, she says, and this is in chapter 5, verse 20, from the heaven they fought, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. And the Gemara in Psochem, in Kuf Yud Ches Amud Beis, in 118b, writes, when Sisera came to fight Israel, he advanced against them with iron spears. Thereupon the Holy One, blessed be He, brought forth the stars out of their orbits against them, as is written, and it quotes the Pasuk in Shoftim, the stars in their courses fought against Sisera. As soon as the stars of the heaven descended upon them, those iron spears became very hot, so they went down to cool them and to refresh themselves in the brook of Kishon. The Holy One, blessed be He, then said to the brook of Kishon, go and deliver your pledge. Straight, and this is explained in the Gemara Psachim, straight away the brook of Kishon swept them out and cast them into the sea, as it is said, the brook Kishon swept them away, that ancient brook. Even the events related to the Makos, the plagues in Egypt, as well as Joshua's conquest of the land of Israel, seem to be related with cosmic activity. As the Avnei Borod, the hail or some meteorite stones were mixed with fire, which rained down from the heaven in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses rained down once again on the enemies of the Jews at the time of Joshua, when, from the vantage point of the earth, the sun and moon stood still. Which again is similar, as we said, about what happened at the Mabel. You know, the Mabel, we said that the week before, it went the other direction. Here it says it stood still. According to the Gemara in Brachos in 54b in Dalet Amud Beis, it seems that they both cluster of stones, came from the same source. And after they rained down on the Egyptians, these stones remained suspended in the sky over 40 years until they came down once again during the time of Yoshua. And here, on page 4, this is taken from a Gemara in Brachos and Nun Dalet Amud Aleph and Amud Beis. The subject of the Gemara is when you see a place where miracles occurred, there's a special blessing which is said. And it goes and relates what these miracles were. The rabbis taught of one sees the place of the crossing of the Red Sea or the fords of the Jordan, you know, when the Jews in the time of Yeshua crossed into Israel, or the fords of the stream of Arnon, or hailstones, Avnei Ogovish, in the descent of Beis Choron is the time of Joshua, or the stone which Og Melech HaBoshen, king of Boshen, wanted to throw at Israel, or the stone on which Moses sat when Yeshua fought with Amalek, or the pillar of salt of Lot's wife, or the wall of Jericho which sank into the ground. For all of these he should give thanksgiving and praise to the Almighty. What are the Avnei Ogovish? Atana taught, stones, avonim, which remain suspended for the sake of a man, agav ish, this is from Moshe, and came down for the sake of man, which is Yeshua. They remain suspended for the sake of man, that was Moses, of whom it is written. Now the man Moses was very meek, ish, he's called ish Moshe. And it is also written, and the thunder and hail ceased, and the rain poured not upon the earth. In other words, it stopped, the mak of Boreth stopped, and it seemed the stones remained suspended. They came down for the sake of man. It seems these same stones now that were suspended 40 years later came down. This was Joshua, of whom it is written, take thee Joshua, Yeshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom there is spirit, and is written, and it came to pass as they fled from before Israel, says, while they were at the descent of Beis Choron, that the Lord cast down great stones. So, and as Yeshua is called Ish, a man is their spirit, so it's Ish, it remained Al-Gav Ish, and as a sin suspended, and it came down because of the other Ish, the Ish Yeshua. But it would seem, Kipshuto, on the surface, that has all the telltale signs of a comet, which rained down ice mixed with methane gas that ignited as it entered the atmosphere, causing untold damage to the enemies, while miraculously sparing the Jews. And again, who knows what other effects this event may have had on the planet as a whole, especially in the light of the fact that the Earth temporarily stood still. The truth is that much of our planetary system gives testimony to the fact that objects from outer space have rained upon them in the past. One interesting case in point is the planet Venus. Unlike the other planets in the solar system, although the two planets, Earth and Venus, have approximately the same diameter, mass, density, and rock composition, and is the closest planet to Earth, yet Venus rotates on its axis far differently than Earth. First of all, unlike the Earth that makes a full rotation once a day on its axis, Venus takes 243 days to make one full rotation. In addition, it rotates in a backward direction compared to Earth and most of the other objects of the solar system. It's quite strange. In addition, Uranus, whose speed of rotation is somewhat similar to that of Earth, makes a complete rotation on its axis in 17 and a quarter hours, where instead of spinning like a top as it orbits the sun, like every other planet, Uranus rolls on its side as it's tilted some 98 degrees. Instead of going like this, it's going like this. How do scientists explain this? They're inclined to believe that these planets must have come into close contact with some celestial objects that tilted Uranus's axis and completely reversed Venus's rotation. In addition, although we are familiar with the craters on the moon, the truth is that much of the solar system is full of craters. In 1974, the Mariner 10 spacecraft photographed about 40% of Mercury's surface in detail. It found that extensive cratered highlands covered much of the surface, making Mercury look like the moon. Many of the satellites of the other planets, like Jupiter's moon Callisto and Saturn's moon, this is Iapetus, show the effects of enormous bombardment of meteors. It goes without saying that today we see almost none of this celestial activity. But it's clear that sometime in the solar system's past, it has come in contact with heavenly bodies that have wreaked havoc on it. Although the paradigm of Earth science is still largely influenced by James Hutton's view of Earth's history, quote, the present is the key to the past, end quote, it is clear that sometime in our past, things have been very, very different. And although the tendency among scientists is to date these cosmic events to our very distant past, the facts are so overwhelming that catastrophes have occurred after life emerged on this planet. That today, even many of the most doctrinaire uniformitarians, those who view the Earth's history only in terms of slow, non-catastrophic change, are forced to admit that the dinosaurs met their end in a dramatic cosmic collision. But of course, not all of them. In 1978, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Luis Alvarez, together with his geologist son Walter, and a group of researchers discovered that clay deposits across the world associated with the end of the period of dinosaurs had concentration of the element iridium, an element which is rare on Earth, but much more abundant in outer space, at levels more than 300 times the norm. At a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, they're full of kofrim, these ones, they announced their discovery, as well as their belief, that the dinosaurs became extinct, not through a slow process taking many millions of years, but through a single explosive event when an object from outer space collided with Earth. Although the idea is quite widely accepted today, not universally, but quite widely accepted, initially it met tremendous resistance. In the words of Bill Bryson in his work A Short History of Nearly Everything, quote, "It was received everywhere, but particularly in the paleontological community, as an outrageous heresy." But there was something much, much deeper and fundamentally abhorrent in the impact theory. The belief that terrestrial processes were gradual and have been elemental in natural history since the time of Lyell. So this is Charles Lyell. By the 1980s, catastrophism had been out of fashion for so long that it became literally unthinkable. For most geologists, the idea of a devastating impact was, as Eugene Shoemaker noted, quote, "against their scientific religion," end quote. Alvarez's theory that a collision with an asteroid caused such terrible damage and unleashed such havoc that almost all of life on this planet was destroyed received additional support when the comet Shoemaker-Levy number 9 collided with the planet Jupiter. In the words of Bill Bryson, again in page 202, one fragment, known as Nucleus G, struck with a force about 6 million megatons. That's 70 times more than all of the nuclear weaponry in existence. Nucleus G was only the size of a small mountain. But it created wounds in the Jovian surface the size of the Earth. It was the final blow to the critics of the Alvarez theory, end quote. Although in a previous lecture we presented some evidence that would seem to indicate that the dinosaurs were perhaps contemporaneous with man, and the extinction or near extinction of the dinosaurs occurred at the time of the great flood of Noah, this view is not presently accepted in the scientific community. But there is much evidence, however, that clearly indicates that extraordinary world-shattering catastrophes occurred in the age of man, of which we will soon speak. It is evident from the Torah's description of the Mabul, the deluge, that it was not merely a local flood. A local flood couldn't have caused the ark to rise above the mountain peaks and finally land on top of Mount Ararat, some 16,000-17,000 feet above sea level. The flood and volcanic activity described in the Torah came with such ferocity that it caused the waters to boil, as we quoted, and rage for more than half a year. This presents a serious problem for many students of the Torah with a scientific background. As the commonly accepted view of geologists and paleontologists is there's absolutely no evidence for a worldwide flood of such proportions, one that's supposed to have occurred only some 4,000 years ago. Such a flood, they argue, should have left rich evidence of the death and destruction that came in its wake, and yet they cannot find any. According to the scientific creationists, however, these are scientists who believe in the reliability of Scripture. Such a flood did occur, and in the process it altered the face of the globe. In contradistinction to secular scholars who tend to view the tremendous sedimentary deposits across the globe having been slowly laid down over hundreds of millions of years, and therefore cannot find any trace of Noah's flood, these religious scientists see the fossils as being relatively new, having been laid down to a large degree at the time of Noah's worldwide deluge. To them, evidence of the flood is to be found all over the world. The problem, the scientific creationists claim, is not with the evidence, but with the dating system currently used by the scientific establishment to interpret the evidence. Because of their secular orientation, secular science tend to view the world as being billions of years old in order there be enough time for life to have risen spontaneously and subsequently evolve without the interference of a divine being. That's why their dating system, which is based upon the axiom of spontaneous evolution, is so sacred to secular scientists. We've explained in the previous lecture, the basic dating system was established before they found support through radiometric dating, about dating the various radioactive isotopes. But basically, the dating came on the assumption, well, it had to evolve. Evolution, as we see, is a very slow process. So therefore, it must have taken all of this time. We quoted many of the arguments of the scientific creationists in previous lectures, including the presence of carbon-14, a substance that is virtually undetectable after 50,000 years, and was found in coal formations that are conventionally dated to be 300 million years old. More recent carbon-14 testing on various samples of fossil wood found in deposits from southern England, supposedly from the Mesozoic era, the age of the dinosaurs, which is commonly dated by scientists to be some 189 million years old, they've discovered detectable carbon-14, which is again only confirmed their position that really there has to be a radical re-examination of the material. In other words, they maintain on the basis of evidence that the whole dating system currently accepted by the scientific establishment needs to be revised. This view of a relatively young Earth, although not presently in vogue, was accepted by virtually, just understand historically, was by virtually all geologists up until the beginning of the 18th century, as we explained in the previous lecture. Although we quoted in a previous lecture the views of Yisrael Lipschitz, the author of Tiferes Yisrael, which we quote here on the bottom of page 4, that the fossils date back from the worlds that existed here before the 6 days of creation, which still may be at least partially so, and may account for the great age of the isotopes, but on the whole, the biblical commentators of the late 19th century tended to attribute the fossils to the Mabel, to the Noah's flood. And here you can look yourselves, as we quote here from the Netziv on page 5. We've quoted this before in a previous lecture. What was life like before the Mabel, before the flood? We know from the fossil record that areas that are today cold and barren were once balmy and warm. Uniformitarian secular geologists interpret this as a proof that the continents have shifted over time due to the movement of the tectonic plates that are beneath the Earth's crust. So that one time Antarctica and the islands of the Arctic were located closer to the equator. This, of course, according to their opinion, took many millions of years. Those who embrace the catastrophic model and view the Earth as relatively new cite the evidence of corals in the Arctic as proof that the Earth's axis was at a different tilt in the past. Let me quote to you from the Medrash Yalkut Shemoni in Parshas Noach. This is Remez 61. This is in translation here we have on top of page 6. Rabbi Acha said, "What caused them to rebel against me?" This is about the people and the period right before the flood. "It was because they sowed, but they didn't reap," I guess because of the abundance. "They gave birth, but didn't bury," and those people lived so long. They became spoiled with the great wealth and blessings. And it continues on, they plant it only once every 40 years. They're able to travel from one end of the earth to the other in a very short time. They would uproot cedars of Lebanon as they walked, and they would regard the lions and leopards as they were lice on their flesh. How was this so? Because they had beautiful weather. It was springtime all year round, as is written, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. This was a change that occurred after the Mabul, but according to this Medrash, before the Mabul you didn't have the seasons. And the Malbim explains, here, this is in the, again the bottom page 6, behold, it has become evident to scientists and the earth that the earth's sphere has changed its orientation, sometimes in the past, for they have found deep within the earth near the polar regions bones of elephants, monkeys, and other creatures that only live in a warm climatic zone. Therefore, at some time in the past, the weather there was similar to that of the equator. This is proof that, during the Mabul, the earth tilted itself from south to north. A country that was once by the equator tilted and moved southerly, northerly, and became a polar region, and the elephants and monkeys that lived in that climate were buried there. This is one of the forms of destruction that occurred to the earth. The warm lands upon which the people who perverted their ways moved away from the sun, and instead of producing lush produce, it now is only a place of cold and frost, an eternal wasteland. Secondly, our sages explained that before the Mabul, the earth was not tilted 23 degrees from the plane of its orbit as it is now, but rather was not tilted or only slightly so. That is why people lived for so long, as they didn't experience the strains brought about by the resulting climatic change of the different seasons which caused disease and sickness. This change, which occurred in the earth's rotation, changed the climate, the nature of the earth's fruit, and diminished the power of the earth to produce for and enhance human and animal life, as is stated in the Medrash. Before the Mabul, there wasn't any sickness in the world. The Medrash relates the unusual feats and super strength of the people of the time, and their infant children were able to prance as sheep as soon as they were born. As people were different. It also relates that it only rained once in 40 years, and they only planted once, and it sufficed for 40 years until the next rain. All of this changed for the worst after the Mabul. It was a result of the change orientation of the earth to the sun. This verse came to inform Noah of the changes that would occur from that day forward. To give you a further sense of what life was like before the Mabul, I would like at this point to quote to you again from Velikovsky's work, Earth in Upheaval, from pages 40 to 42. I quote, Spitsbergen in the Arctic Ocean is as far north from Oslo in Norway as Oslo is from Naples. Here, this is a scientist, identified 136 species of fossil plants from Spitsbergen. Spitsbergen is 78 degrees, 56 minutes north latitude, which he ascribed to the Tertiary Age. According to the standard dating system, that's the age of mammals, before the age of man. Among the plants were pines, firs, spruces, and cypresses, also elms, hazels, and water lilies. At the northernmost tip of Spitsbergen archipelago, a bed of black and lustrous coal 25 to 30 feet thick was found. Is covered black shale and sandstone encrusted with fossilized land plants. Quote, "When we remember that this vegetation grew luxuriantly within 8 degrees 15 minutes of the North Pole, in a region which is in darkness for half of the year, it is now almost continuously buried under snow and ice, we can realize the difficulty of the problem of the distribution of climate which these facts present to the geologist." End quote. This is taken from the Archibald Geikie's The Textbook of Geology. There must have been great forests, Velikovsky continues on Spitsbergen to produce a bed of coal 30 feet thick. And even at Spitsbergen, almost 1,000 miles inside the Arctic Circle, for some unknown reason, had the warm climate of the French Riviera on the Mediterranean. Still, these thick forests could have not have grown there because the place is 6 months in continuous night. The rest of the year, the sun stands low over the horizon. Not only fossil trees and corals, but corals too were found there. Corals grow only in tropical water. In the Mediterranean, the climate of Egypt or Morocco, it is too cold for them. But they grew in Spitsbergen. Today, large formations of coral covered with snow can be seen. It does not solve the problem of their deposition if they were formed in an older geological epoch. At some time in the remote past, corals grew and are still found on the entire fringe of polar North America, in Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. In later times, the tertiary, fig palms bloomed within the Arctic Circle, forests of Sequoia gigantea, and as the giant trees of California, grew from Bering Strait to north of Labrador. And he quotes, this is from D.H. Campbell, Continental Drift and Plant Distribution, published in Science Magazine, January 16, 1942, is difficult to imagine any possible condition of climate which these plants could grow so near the pole, deprived of sunlight for many months of the year, end quote. It is usually said that the ages past the climate, it is usually said that in ages past, the climate all over the world was the same, or that a characteristic of the warm periods which have formed the major part of the geological time was the small temperature difference between equatorial and polar regions. To this, C.E.P. Brooke, in his book Climate Throughout the Ages, says, so long as the axis of rotation remains in nearly its present position relative to the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun, the outer limit of the atmosphere in tropical regions must receive more of the sun's heat than in the middle latitudes, and the middle latitudes more than the polar region. This is an invariable law. It is much more difficult to think of a cause which will raise the temperature of polar regions by 30 degrees Fahrenheit or more while leaving that of equatorial regions almost unchanged. End quote. The continent of Antarctica is larger than Europe, European Russia included. It is not a single tree, not a single bush, not a single blade of grass. Very few fungi have been found. Reports of polar explorers indicate that no land animals larger than insects have been seen, and these insects are exceedingly few and degenerate. Penguins and seagulls come from the sea. Storms of great velocity circle the Antarctic most of the year. The greatest part of the continent is covered with ice that in some places descends into the ocean. E.H. Shackleton, during his expedition to Antarctica in 1907 to 1909, found fossil wood in the sandstone of a moraine at altitude 85 degrees, this is in 5 minutes. He also found erratic boulders of granite on the slopes of Mount Erebus, a volcano. Then he discovered seven seams of coal, also at about latitude 85 degrees. The seams are each about 3 to 7 feet thick, associated with the coal, a sandstone containing coniferous wood. According to Chamberlain, coal is found only 200 miles from the South Pole. And he continues on, Antarctica too must have had great forests in the past. It often appears that the historian of climate has chosen a field as hard to master as it is to square the circle. It seems sometime that the history of climate is a collection of unsolved, even unsolvable questions. Without drastic changes in the position of the terrestrial axis or in the form of the orbit or both, and conditions could not have existed in which tropical plants flourished in polar regions. If anyone is not convinced of this, he should try to cultivate coral at the North Pole. End quote. It's worth noting that even though the Earth may have tilted during the flood, it seems that subsequently the Earth continued to experience cosmic disturbances that may have changed the Earth's tilt. For instance, in his Worlds in Collision, Velikovsky cites the odd fact that a sundial and water clock discovered in Egypt dating from at least before the 7th or 8th centuries before the Common Era, indicate that Egypt had a different orientation than that of today, and that the tilt or perhaps even the length of the day was different than today's. Of that and the events that may have triggered these changes, we will speak in Mirtz Hashem in a future lecture. Another suggested cause for the change in weather after the Mabul is the loss of the vapor canopy that many believe existed before the Mabul. In the last lecture, we quoted the Malbim's explanation of the source of the torrential rain during the flood. After all, as been pointed out, that generally there is so little water vapor at any one time in the air, how could rain, even if it lasted for 40 days, contribute significantly to the rise of the waters above the mountains and to the destruction of life on this earth? Regarding this, that the Malbim state, and here we have this on page 7, this is paragraph C, he says, our sages have explained that during the flood, God returned the world to its original state at the time of creation, when there's emerging of the waters. I've quoted this before in previous lecture. As I've already clarified in the verse, let there be a firmament, and in the verse, let the waters be gathered. Initially, the original waters surrounded the globe of the earth, and through God's statement, let there be a firmament, the misty water rose up until it reached a place where the clouds were situated, for he made it, or above the clouds, for he made a division between the water which was above the clouds, which remained water in the potential form of vapor, and the lower waters which are in liquid form. So the half of the water was above the firmament. We explained that the firmament, which is, would be the tropopause, and half was in the ocean. At the time of the flood, however, through the word of God, they all fell below to the earth. Now there's all of this vapor that rose, who knows how many hundreds of miles up, surrounded the earth, all fell down. As it stated, the window of the heavens opened. This is referred to the storehouses of the heavens in which the abundance of water in the form of vapor was stored and was suspended there through the command of the king. In addition, the deep subterranean waters opened through seismic activity that occurred in the bowels of the earth where fires are constantly raging, as is well known from the volcanoes, which spew forth fire and it boil the water in the deep. As the water expanded because of the immense heat, it broke through the earth's crust and rose above it. This is what our sages meant when they said that the water was boiling, for this was subterranean water, like the hot springs which issue forth from the bowels of the earth till this day. It has been suggested, if there did exist such a vapor canopy, it would have created a greenhouse effect, which would have lifted the temperature of the earth by several degrees, would have ameliorated the effects of winter. In addition, the existence of such a vapor canopy would retard the formation of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, as it would form a barrier against the cosmic rays that normally hit the air and change nitrogen into carbon-14, as we explained in a previous lecture. With a vapor canopy, as explained by the Malbim, the cosmic rays would barely reach Earth, and therefore very little carbon-14 would be formed. For that reason, since there was so little carbon-14 in the atmosphere to begin with, any test on wood or coal from that era would seem to be much older than 4 to 6,000 years since the wood was formed. Now, age is generally determined by the amount of carbon-14 that is in a specimen. Assuming that there was the same amount in the atmosphere than there is today, then a small amount of carbon-14 in comparison to a modern carbon-based object is indicative that a long time has elapsed, allowing the carbon-14, which is unstable, to dissipate. Well, you have a little bit, but it must be very old, assuming that it had that much as it is today. But the carbon-14 dates for fossils or wood from the period closer to the Mabul, before or after, since so little was there to begin with, would give the erroneous impression of appearing much older than they really are. In addition to this factor, we quoted the scientific creationist claim that the magnetic field on Earth is presently decaying and that in antiquity it was much stronger. Such a strong magnetic field would also have the capability of protecting the Earth from cosmic rays, and therefore during that period of high magnetism, very little carbon-14 would have formed. It has also been suggested that another source for the rain that lasted for 40 days is a tremendous volcanic eruptions that shook the earth at the time of the Mabul. As in the words of Scripture, the fountains of the great deep broke up. A large percentage of what spews out of a volcano is water vapor. The water vapor that continued to rise from the bowels of the earth, supplemented with the vapor rising from the heated oceans, provided a tremendous source for continuous rain that lasted for so long. In addition, this volcanic action explains one of the great mysteries of earth science, the source of the ice age. There's a general consensus that there was a time which was contemporaneous with man, at least partially, that 30% of the Earth's surface, including almost all of Canada and considerable parts of northern and central United States, northern Europe, and northwest Asia, where man is standing now, was covered with a thick sheet of ice. The ice sheet which covers Greenland is understood to be a mere remnant of that ice sheet. In addition, this ice sheet seems to have melted at least partially and refroze at least three times. We spoke about these four ice, the four glacial periods and the three interglacial periods. The source of this ice age, or ice ages, is a subject of intense debate. On the one hand, there must have been something that caused the temperature of the northern hemisphere to plummet to below freezing during the summers for so many years on end to prevent the ice from melting, because if it would be warm in the summer, it would just have melted off. On the other hand, however, when it is extremely cold, there's very little snowfall, as cold air does not carry with it much precipitation. Snowstorms which cause a heavy snowfall usually occur when the weather is just below freezing, not when it is very cold. What could have caused both tremendous cold yet heavy precipitation? There's much evidence to point to the fact that the events of the Mabul precipitated the ice age, as the heated water of the seas created much evaporation, and subsequent rain and snowfall, especially in the polar regions. So it rose, the water was hot, but it evaporated, and it formed in clouds and went to the polar regions where it fell as snow. In addition, the ash, which was spewed from the volcanoes that erupted then, would have darkened the sky, blocking sunlight and lowering the Earth's temperature, especially in the polar regions. The eruption of a single volcano, Krakatoa, in Indonesia in 1883 is believed responsible for causing a worldwide drop in temperature that lasted for 5 years. That's just a single volcano. A similar effect occurred when the volcano Tambora in Indonesia in 1815, which unleashed an unprecedented series of cold spells in the northeastern United States and Canada. In June of 1816, following the eruption, New England received 6 inches of snow. I mean, I know New England, even for 6 inches in the summer is rare. And temperatures went down to 37 degrees in August. Mark Twain said about New England, if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute. This is extreme. The Mabul would have created the same scenario, only exponentially worse. Although the ocean was warm due to the blockage of sunlight due to volcanic activity, the land became cooled, especially at the poles, and an ice sheet developed that extended southward to mid-America. With so much of the Earth's water stored in the form of terrestrial glaciers, the oceans would have lowered, creating land bridges between Siberia and Alaska, by which the Indians reached America, and probably also between the East Indies and Australia and New Zealand. And this is where the Aborigines came. Eventually, as the volcanoes died down and the ash cleared from the atmosphere, temperatures would have climbed, making the glaciers melt and the oceans rise. Until, of course, another cosmic catastrophe may have hit the Earth, as we'll explain in the following lecture. Although the commonly accepted view is that it must have taken many thousands of years for the great mountains of ice to have formed, it is pointed out that it isn't necessarily so. During World War II, a squadron of 8 fighter planes left the U.S. Army base in Greenland, headed for Great Britain. A massive blizzard, however, forced them to turn back. Unable to touch down in Iceland, as they had hoped, The squadron, running out of fuel, was forced to crash land on an eastern Greenland ice sheet. Fortunately, all of the crewmen were rescued. In 1988, it's a little over 40 years, an effort was made to salvage the planes. They had assumed that the planes were under a thin covering of ice. After all, only some 45 years had passed by. However, when the radar located the planes, they were shocked to learn they were under approximately 250 feet of ice. Even today, in the relatively mild conditions, the ice can form quickly. This is not a marble. The men who experienced the Ice Age left us a rich legacy of cave paintings illustrating what life was like during those times, of which we'll speak in Mirza Hashem in a future lecture. But the Ice Age eventually came to a dramatic end, as the animal life of the period, as the woolly mammoth, mastodon, super bison, together with rhinoceroses, lions, and horses, the northern hemisphere met a catastrophic end. There's much evidence that all of this occurred in the age of historic man. Velikovsky pointed out that where the woolly mammoths were found, frozen solid in Siberia, in a place that today supports virtually no life, a Bronze Age metallurgy shop was found. Of this and more we'll speak in Mirza Hashem in a future lecture. After Noach left the Teva, the Ark, God reassured him that life once again would flourish, but now in an altered state. One that would make it more difficult to sink to the depths that mankind fell during the years prior to the flood. Again, this is, we quote here on page 8. This is God reassured him, says that he will not destroy every living thing. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. If, as the creationists argue, that the Ice Age began right after the flood, as a result of the conditions that prevailed then, one can understand that it was purposely intended to make sure that life, at least in its inception after the marble, would be harsh enough for man to start life once again on a more moral footing. In the words of the Malbim, here, this is on the bottom page 8. While the earth remains, literally the days of the earth, years of the earth, seed time and the harvest, etc. In other words, they will plant and reap every year. Before the marble, however, they only plant to reap once every 40 years. But now, every single year, they will be planting and harvesting. A second change that occurred was the change of seasons. Before the flood, the earth was perpendicular to the plane of orbit to the sun, and there wasn't cold and heat, summer and winter, but now there was a 23.5-degree tilt from the perpendicular that would commence to be cold and heat in summer and winter. The change of air and weather during the seasons weakens the body and subdues the physical element of man so that he will no longer continue in the perverse ways which were predominant before the marble. The third change is the night and day he shall not cease laboring. For the land will not easily produce fruit as it was prior to the marble, and mankind will be forced to constantly work the ground in order to produce bread. As a result, they will not have the free time to entertain sinful thoughts to which they would normally be attracted. From this did our sages derive that the descendants of Noach, with the exception of the Jewish people, are not allowed to have a rest day. Only the Jews were allowed and commanded to rest. The rest of mankind remained with the original prohibition. End quote. We'll continue on in Mirza Hashem next week with the generation of the Tower of Babel and what occurred then. Now, are there any questions?
The angle of the earth, if it changed so often, it would come out like Eretz Yisrael would have been in a whole region at one point. Or where the Garden of Eden theoretically would be, if you would shift the polar cap to an area that would be able to support that type of vegetation, you're shifting everything.
Yeah, your question about shifting the polar cap. The contention of the Malbim is not that the necessarily that it was shifted. It was perpendicular. It was not at a shift. It was really perpendicular to the thing. So therefore, there were no seasons. Mm-hmm. It was just like a top.
Right.
So according to them, really, you didn't have the shift of seasons, and it could be with the vapor canopy as well that there was a certain homogeneous form of weather that was really all over. It was really warm and pleasant. So really didn't have to tilt this way or that. It was really perpendicular originally, and then it got the shift. And it could be, it was related also to the cosmic activity that we explained before.
How does continental drift fit into all this? Could you explain?
Yeah, so the question is, how is continental drift? On one hand, continental drift is the means that scientists explain the occurrence of coral near the North Pole. That basically that the continents have shifted so that the area near the North Pole was once at the equator and everything is moving. That's really how they used to explain this. How it shifted in the first place, or what caused continental drift, why is it so? I mean, it's not clear. How the approach that we're taking, and this is that really originally, as there is evidence that originally there was one continent. It wasn't the many continents. It was torn apart by this cosmic activity. It was like the Earth. You have to realize this is stopping, and the whole Earth was torn apart, and that really caused the breaking of the continents, and basically the continental drift. I'm not sure you have to say, according to this thing, that Antarctica originally was different, but much, much different than it is today. It could be the polar regions, everything was closer together. You know, they were closer together, and they have drifted apart, so now Antarctica is by the pole. However, you don't necessarily have to say that it was in one place and it was another place and they kept on drifting. It was really like one continent. Everything was warm, and that was the reason that it formed these things. And the process that destroyed the world during the Mabel and created the formation of all the coal equally affected what is today Antarctica and the polar regions. And as a result of what occurred in the Mabel, things drastically moved. Today that they're moving an inch a year is only because things have already slowed down. But it could very well be during this time of the Mabel that was very quick, and it was vast, abrupt change. What?
Time the Mabel, the water resort went away very quickly. The Earth dried out. The water resort.
Right.
No water left for an ice age.
No. So he's saying that the water, first of all, that the water really absorbed below the Earth, but much of that water that remained really evaporated and went and formed by the northern areas, or wherever in the polar areas, where towards mid America. Just like the waters that now didn't. I mean, there's waters that were absorbed, waters that weren't absorbed. If everything was absorbed, we could walk on the bottom of the Pacific too. But evidently not all the water was absorbed. It was just saying that the abundance of water was absorbed. There was much water that wasn't absorbed. Of that water that wasn't absorbed, much of it evaporated and formed ice that eventually melted and again went back into the seas. I mean, this is their contention. Yeah. This is that we quoted the Medrash, right? And so we quoted the Medrash that there were no seasons, and this just fits well into the idea, therefore, that the whole world at one time was a very pleasant, balmy. If you have any questions if things have changed or not, just walk outside. But, okay, a good tovach.